One verse from this Psalm 78, verse 53. Noticing that the title of the psalm is a mashkil of Asaph, meaning a psalm that gives instruction, and Asaph is the author of it. Psalm 78 and then verse 53. And he led them on safely, so that they feared not, but the sea overwhelmed their enemies. This is one of a number of psalms written by Asaph. Psalm 50 is one, and then the Psalms 73 to 83 are by this man. He was a prophet and a composer of words and music. And this man, Asaph, was on a par with David as one of the sweet psalmists of Israel. In 2 Chronicles 29, verse 30, we read, "Moreover, Hezekiah the king and the princes commanded the Levites to sing praise unto the Lord with the words of David and of Asaph the seer." So in that verse you see the Psalms of David were appointed to be sung by Hezekiah in his day, and also those by Asaph the seer or the prophet, and they are spoken together in that way, this Asaph on a par with David. And of course the city of St. Asaph is named after him, the second smallest city in Britain. Asaph, but the Welsh say Asaph. I don't know which is the Hebrew, but anyway, we know about that place and we know who has given his name to it. But if you read the Psalms of Asaph, you will love them because there are certain features about them that prove such a blessing. For instance, his utter honesty. Psalm 73 we know about, the problem that he had with the prosperity of the wicked, compared with his own trials and tribulations every day of his life, and how that he almost stumbled in his mind and lost his faith because it seemed that God was better to the wicked than to his own people. And Psalm 73 is his testimony of how that he was almost over the edge, but the Lord rescued and brought him to a right understanding and restored him and brought him to confidence again. And that's his testimony, Psalm 73, and he holds nothing back. It's all shared with us with utter honesty. And then his concern for what people will think of God when it seems that the Lord is not working and not blessing, and his church is suffering and his cause is going down. Psalm 74 verse 22, for instance, where he says, "Arise, O God, plead thine own cause. Remember how the foolish man reproacheth thee daily." What a word for today that is, isn't it? And the way that Asaph also looks back and recounts the history of God's dealings with his people Israel. Now Psalm 78 is all about that. One of the longer of the Psalms of Asaph, but he goes over the history of Israel and the way the Lord led his people through the wilderness. And you come to verse 53, and of course it's the Red Sea. "He led them on safely, so that they feared not, but the sea overwhelmed their enemies, the Egyptians." Well now, let us look at this verse together and see how this sums up that memorable event of Israel at the Red Sea, and look at it in terms of an illustration of how that there are crises in the lives of God's people and yet the Lord brings them through. "He led them on safely so that they feared not, but the sea overwhelmed their enemies." Well, in order to do that, Let us notice the two conjunctions or connecting words in this verse. And, but. And he led them on safely so that they feared not, but the sea overwhelmed their enemies. Now, two little words like that might seem unimportant, and how can they indicate two points of a sermon? Well, there is nothing unimportant in the Bible, and even the smaller words are crucial. So let us see then from these two things what the message is of this event. First of all, and he led them on safely so that they feared not. Let's go back to the record of what happened, recorded for us historically in Exodus chapter 14. Now here we know the story. Pharaoh decided to pursue the Israelites. They had lately escaped from Egypt, redeemed by the mighty power of God and through the blood of the Passover. But now he decides to pursue the Israelites. Exodus 14 verse 5. And it was told the king of Egypt that the people fled, and the heart of Pharaoh and his servants was turned against the people. And they said, "Why have we done this, that we have let Israel go from serving us?" And he made ready his chariot and took his people with him and the chosen chariots and so on, and pursued after the children of Israel. Either it was to recapture the Israelites or perhaps destroy them once and for all. But Pharaoh gathered together an elite force of 600 chariots and many others, and it seemed as if he commanded the force himself, and all these quickly bore down upon the slow-moving Israelites, and they were in terrible danger now. Exodus 14 verse 10. When Pharaoh drew nigh, the children of Israel lifted up their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians marched after them, and they were sore afraid. And their terror was simply this: that there was no escaping. Behind was the pursuing Egyptians. Either side of them was open wilderness. So if they tried to run to the right or to the left, the Egyptians would simply overtake them. In front of them were the deep waters of the Red Sea. And as the Egyptians bore down upon them, they were closer and closer to the Red Sea, and they were becoming boxed in to a cul-de-sac. There was no escape. Behind, to either side, in front, there was nowhere to go. Time was running out. It was a no-win situation. It could not be worse. Almost really worse than their time in Egypt, when they were slaves. Now it seemed as if this was the end of them altogether. And dear friends, isn't that sometimes like that with us? We are boxed in to a situation. We are surrounded on either, on every side, and there is just nowhere to go. It's a no-win situation, and we just do not know what to do. We're almost at our wit's end, and the longer time goes by, the more urgent and more terrible the thing seems to be. But we have to go somewhere. We have to do something. But there seems no way of escape, and it seems as if we're given up to the inevitable. Now let's remember this, that it was one stage on the journey to Canaan. And he led them on safely. And it was just one of those stages on the way to Canaan. And it has happened, and similar will happen again. And this is the way it is. And so for us on our way to heaven, it will be one of those things. And in addition to everything else. And so we're told in 1 Peter 4 and verse 12, "Think it not strange, as though some strange thing were happening to you." It's one of those things. If the Israelites thought that now they were redeemed from Egypt and were a free people, that everything was going to be smooth and straightforward and easy from now on, this was their great shock. But in fact it was not. This came not so many days after their release and their freedom, and they're in desperate straits now, worse than when they were in Egypt. It reminds us, of course, that when we're converted, it's not the end of all our problems in life. It can often be the beginning of problems we never had before. Peculiar to Christians, peculiar to the pilgrimage that Christians make to heaven. But that's why, of course, we join the church. That's why we're under a pastoral ministry. That's why we belong to the Lord and to one another, so that we can be helped in such dire straits and ministered to and enabled to go through safely. And he led them on safely. And we grow in faith. We are able to cope. We are benefited by such experiences. So it's just one stage on the journey. And another thing is this. God himself brought about their crisis. Notice, and he led them on. It was the action of God that brought them into this no-win situation. If you look at Exodus chapter 14 and the opening verses, you'll see that it's quite clear that the Lord did this. The Lord spake unto Moses, saying, speak unto the children of Israel that they turn and encamp before Pi-Hahiroth, between Migdol and the sea, over against Baal-Zephon, before it shall ye encamp by the sea. And where did Pharaoh find the people? Go to verse 9. The chariots of Pharaoh and his horsemen and his army overtook them encamping by the sea, beside Pi-Hahiroth, before Baal-Zephon. In other words, God told them to swing south and take this route, which would lead them right to the border of the Red Sea in this particular place. He led them that way by the fiery, cloudy pillar, right into the place where they would be pursued and overtaken by Pharaoh in this terrifying situation. Now God brought them into this no-win situation. Not the Israelites, but God. Not the Egyptians, but God. Not the devil, but God. He led them on. And it reminds us of a very important truth, doesn't it? That the author of all our trials and troubles and dire straits is always God. And that's his high sovereignty, whereby he appoints these things for us. He does not allow them to happen. He appoints them and sends them and brings them to pass. And we've got to be clear about this, dear friends. Ephesians 1 and verse 11 that we read just now, predestined according to the purpose of him who worketh all things after the counsel of his own will. Not some things or most things and the rest he allows, but all things after the counsel of his own will. And as surely as our salvation by grace is predestined before the world began, so every trial and tribulation and trouble and sets of dire straits are equally predestined from back then and worked out. He does not merely allow these things to happen. If he merely allows these things to happen, he's a bystander, he's a spectator. And who is in control then, if these things are allowed? These things are then in others' hands. No, these things are not allowed
as if God lets them happen, and then he's got to somehow react to these circumstances and try to come in and limit the damage and overrule them for good. No, God is there all the way through, from beginning to end. And we call it a grievous providence, perhaps. A heavy providence, but a providence. And to trace up all our trials and straits to God is the beginning of our being helped. The author of them becomes the one who will appear for us, for our help. So you see, God brought them into this crisis. He led them on. And so it is for us, dear friends. Can you trace your trials and sufferings and troubles and heartaches to the heart and the mind of God? Unless you can do that, you won't have the ultimate comfort and the ultimate hope. Don't talk about the devil being in charge. Don't talk about bad luck or fate or people or things. Our view of divine providence is such that God is the God of the worst that happens in life, as well as the best that happens in life. And we give him the glory when we acknowledge that. And we give him the glory when we trust in him for all we need. He led them on. Another thing was that they were perfectly secure. The text tells us, doesn't it? Psalm 78, verse 53. And he led them on safely. Now, it's hard to imagine them being safe when they're utterly terrified. And time is running out, and it seems as if they're going to be swallowed up by their enemies, and they've nowhere to go, no possible route of escape. But God led them on safely. They could not have been more safe. They were as safe now as they would be one day in the land of Canaan. But we can quite understand them not feeling safe. If you look at Exodus 14 and verse 10, the end of verse 10 and the beginning of verse 11, look how true to life this is. They were sore afraid, and the children of Israel cried out unto the Lord. Well, that's a very promising thing, isn't it? Betaking themselves to prayer. But look what comes next in verse 11. And they said to Moses, because there were no graves in Egypt, hast thou taken us away to die in the wilderness? Why didn't you leave us alone in Egypt? And so on. With one breath they cry to the Lord in prayer, and the very next breath they're complaining to Moses and blaming all the troubles on him. And isn't that so typical? You can one minute be praying, and then you finish praying, and the next minute you're complaining about things to somebody and blaming it on second causes or something. How true to life. And have we really prayed then when we do that? Just sweet, comforting time of taking it to the Lord in prayer, and the next minute grumbling and complaining to the person nearest to us. What inconsistency. But it's pressure, it's fear that does that. We're being led on safely. We're perfectly safe and secure in God's providence. But we don't feel it. And it's a struggle to pray, a struggle to get peace. And so easy to give way to complaints and blaming on people and things. Ah, but you see, the God who appointed this crisis also knew what he was going to do. And it was quite right to pray to him. He's going to lead his people right through the Red Sea. And he's going to glorify himself. And so God dealt with their fears, and he led them on safely, so that they feared not. Now see what God did, what God said to them to quell their fears and teach them to trust him. Look at verse 13. Verses 13 to 15 in Exodus 14 will show us this. Let's trace it.
Verse 13, "Fear ye not, stand still." Now that was the first thing they needed to do. There was panic, there was desperation, there was urgency, the thing was critical, the time factor. And that's what often intensifies our trial. Time's running out. But you see, we must stop. "Fear ye not, stand still." We're often told to do this, no matter how urgent and pressing and desperate the thing might be. You lose no time in standing still. In Ruth chapter 3, verse 18, there's another example where you know the story, how that Boaz is going to see this nearer relative who can assert his prior claim upon Naomi's property and can marry Ruth. Boaz has promised to do this, but he's got to negotiate with this nearer kinsman who has the first right to do it. And while he's away doing this, Ruth and Naomi are together in the house, and the two women are waiting for Boaz's return and what the outcome will be. Time is going by. Ruth is getting up, pacing the floor, and then sitting down again. Getting up, pacing the floor, sitting down again, agitated, anxious, until Naomi finally says, "Sit still, my daughter. Sit still. The man will not be in rest until he hath finished the thing this day." And that's good counsel. Sit still. The Lord won't rest until he's finished the thing. He's going to see it through. It's in his hands, not ours. "Fear ye not, stand still." Psalm 37, verse 7, where we're told to rest in the Lord. Wait patiently for him. He's in charge. Or of course, Psalm 46, verse 10, "Be still and know that I am God." He's over all. You see, we are most often helped when we do nothing but go to God in prayer and quietly wait upon him. And we're led on safely. And then expect God to appear for you. Look at verse 13 again. "Fear ye not, stand still, and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will show you today." In other words, the same God who has appointed the situation is the one who will come in for his people and open up the way. Somehow or other, they didn't know exactly what yet, but somehow or other God would come as the delivering God, and God would see them through. We must keep the two together, mustn't we? He who has appointed will be the one who will appear. The one who has done this will do the other. And we look to him. A God-centered outlook, you see. It means that in our trials we're shut up. We're not really shut up to circumstances. We're shut up to God, aren't we? And we wait upon him to come in for us. And it's good for us. It brings us closer. It teaches us to pray. It means we throw everything upon him, ourselves included, and we're utterly, utterly abandoned to God. That's how he exercises us and teaches faith and dependence to grow and teaches us to know him more and prove him more. And you see, the way forward will be made. And how did he do it? Well, this is it. This illustrates what he will do. Verse 15. "Moses said unto the Lord, Wherefore criest thou unto me?" It's not the time for prayer, Moses. It's the time for action. Sometimes, you see, we pray when we should act. At other times, we act when we should pray. But here Moses was praying when he should have been acting. "Wherefore criest thou unto me? Speak unto the children of Israel that they go forward." Now that was the way. That was the way, and that was what they must do. Go forward. And we know, of course, from verse 22 of Exodus 14, "And the children of Israel went into the midst of the sea upon the dry ground, and the waters were a wall unto them on their right hand and on their left. And he led them on safely, so that they feared not." And you see, the way God took to deliver them was to command them to go forward and to keep going, and God would see them through. Not so much that a way would be found, but a way would be made. And they had to go forward in faith, trusting in God. And as they began to enter the waters opened up and they went on dry ground. And those very waters that were such a threat to them before became protecting walls either side. And they went forward. And you see, translated into our experience in life, what happens is that we go forward, in the sense that we keep going as Christians into each new day by faith, looking to him to make the way for us. The only way to go is forward. The only thing to do is to keep going and to keep trusting and to keep looking to him. And it's a hard thing to do. Some of God's people, when they wake up in the morning, all they feel like is keeping the bedclothes over themselves and staying there all day. They can't face the day. But you see, God says, go forward. And we get up and we believe that his compassions fail not. They are new every morning. We go into the day in his strength and find grace is given. As our days, so shall our strength be. And we go forward. And God, as it were, opens up the Red Sea. And God helps us through. And he makes the way for us day after day after day. And so they found. He led them on safely, so that they feared not. And the way out, the solution, the resolving of the matter, was to go forward in faith, continuing to follow God. And that's how it is. And we are delivered in the trial. The Lord deals with these straits by enabling us to carry on and carry on and carry on. And he is there before us, dealing with these things. He is at our side and close by. And the promise is Isaiah 43 verse 2. "When thou passest through the waters, I will be with thee, and through the rivers, they shall not overflow thee." And the thing ahead of us that is such an insuperable obstacle, such a frightening problem, is the thing we go into head on when we know that God is calling us, and we find that the way opens up and the thing is marvellously dealt with. And we find that he has led us on safely, and we fear not. It's a question of proving him, isn't it? Proving him, the God of every Red Sea situation. The God who in his covenant commitment to his people will never fail any one of them. So you see, there is that first conjunction. And one of those things. Just one experience on the way to Canaan. It won't be the last. There'll be others. But we go through them. He led them on safely, so that they feared not. And so, dear friends, we are enabled to keep going. The wonderful thing about being a Christian is that, unlike the world, we don't indulge in escapism. We don't, like the world, give up in despair and grind to a halt because we are without hope. We follow his command. We go forward. We live one day at a time and find that he is going before and he is with us. And every Red Sea situation, every impossible situation whereby we are boxed in, we find if we are in the Lord's way and are following him, he will open the way for us. The God who has appointed He's the God who will appear.
And let's look now at this other conjunction in the text. But
the sea overwhelmed their enemies. Well, we know that that was so from Exodus 14 and verses 27 and 28. And Moses stretched forth his hand over the sea, and the sea returned to his strength when the morning appeared, and the Egyptians fled against it. And the Lord overthrew the Egyptians in the midst of the sea, and the waters returned and covered the chariots and the horsemen and all the hosts of Pharaoh that came into the sea after them. There remained not so much as one of them. But the children of Israel walked upon dry land in the midst of the sea, and the waters were a wall unto them on their right hand and on the left. Thus the Lord saved Israel that day. But the sea overwhelmed their enemies. And what a complete work the Lord did that day. Not only a deliverance for this present, but really it removed the problem for the future. They would never again be threatened by the Egyptians. There would be other enemies to encounter. There would be other dire straits to face. But this one would never happen again. The Egyptians were wiped out. And that Red Sea was the barrier between them and Egypt forever. And if you think about it, just as an aside, wasn't it a just judgment of God upon the Egyptians? Pharaoh had made that cruel edict that all the boy babies of the Israelites be thrown into the Nile and drowned in order to cut off any future generation of Israelites. And he who wanted the boy babies of God's people drowned, he and all his men are now drowned in the deep waters of the Red Sea. And there is a poetic justice in God's dealings. And sometimes God makes the punishment exactly fit the sin. Whatsoever a man soweth, that shall he also reap. What a fearful, terrible thing it is, isn't it? And history has shown very often in God's governmental dealings with nations that dictators and monsters of iniquity, terrible tyrants, wicked, cruel people, the things that they did to thousands, millions of people, a similar thing happens to them. But what a sad contrast, isn't it, that we have in this text. But the sea overwhelmed their enemies. That sea that was opened up for the Lord's covenant people, that very same sea overwhelmed and drowned the enemies, the Egyptians. And what a change, because you see, to begin with, the Egyptians were not in trouble like the Israelites, were they? The Egyptians had the upper hand. The Egyptians had all the power of horses and chariots on their side. And here was this group, this company of slow-moving Israelites, exposed and vulnerable and being pursued and gobbled up as prey. And the Egyptians were riding high. They were ungodly, heathen, wicked. And they had it all their way. And here's the Lord's people threatened almost to extinction. But now look, it's all swapped around, isn't it? And you see, as we've said, this prosperity of the wicked sometimes is a problem for the Lord's people. Psalm 73, another of the Psalms of Asaph. Like I said, in that psalm, verses 5 and 6, here is his problem stated. Psalm 73 verse 5.
They are not in trouble as other men, these wicked, ungodly, prosperous people. Neither are they plagued like other men. Therefore pride compasseth them about as a chain, violence covereth them as a garment, their eyes stand out with fatness, they have more than heart could wish. And he describes these ungodly, these corrupt people who go strutting about the place, defying God, and the Lord seeming to prosper them. And look, verse 12, these are the ungodly who prosper in the world, they increase in riches. Verily I've cleansed my heart in vain and washed my hands in innocency. All the day long have I been plagued and chastened every morning. And it is a problem,
because compared with the way that so many non-Christians seem to get on in the world so happily and smoothly and remarkably well, the Lord's people are beset with temptations, struggles, conflicts, troubles, tried and tested and so on.
Ah, but you see, remember this, when it comes to the crunch, those who are not Christians don't have the Lord to help them. And when the Egyptians were in danger, the Red Sea overwhelmed them, and they did not have the help of the God of Israel. And the time comes, dear friends, for non-Christians. Their time does come. They might in younger life perhaps escape the troubles and trials of Christian people. And they might always seem to land on their feet and things go well. But as the time goes by, you don't always see the end of the story and how things progress. And when they come to be bereaved, when they get a serious illness, when their world starts falling apart, where do they go? To whom do they turn? Because they're without Christ, aliens from the commonwealth of Israel, strangers from the covenants of promise, having no hope and without God in the world. And you see, but the sea overwhelmed them. They had no hope, no help in Israel's God like Israel had. And they were found out and they sank, and that was the end of them. And we pity them, don't we? And we pity those who are not Christians. We would not, for all the difficulties that beset the Christian pilgrimage, we would not exchange it for the way of the wicked. In all their prosperity and ease and seeming success and happiness, we would not exchange it for a moment, because the time comes for us all when we shall need a God to go to, and we shall need a higher help, and we shall need to know that these things are appointed by a loving, all-wise God, and he appears for his people every time. And those who are not Christians don't have this. And I wonder if this applies to you tonight. And have you been looking on, and perhaps you've seen how Christians cope with their trials and troubles? Sometimes we don't cope very well, sadly. But that's not the Lord's fault, it's our fault. But at least you see that Christian people are helped through and are strengthened by their experiences. And you think, ah, if that's what being a Christian is, I'm glad I'm not a Christian. But your time will come. Your time will come. And when it does, where will you go? And what will be your resolve? Godless and worldly, you've got nothing, and you'll be overwhelmed by the troubles and heartaches, and you'll sink, because there's no one in all this world who can really help you. They're all in the same boat. Man is born to trouble as the sparks fly upward. It's inevitable that we shall meet troubles and trials, all of us. I wouldn't exchange being a Christian with being a worldling for anything. I'd rather have the struggles and difficulties of the Christian life than the world at their best and happiest, because it's only temporary and empty and hollow. It'll fade away. And what about when you come to die? What about when your end comes and there's no hope, and you've got to face the ultimate, the king of terrors, death? And what a desperate and awful thing that will be, without God, without hope in the world. And the sea of death will overwhelm you, and you'll go out into an eternity to face God with no hope of heaven and glory. And isn't it even for that reason a wise thing to not rest until you know for sure that you've repented of your sin, you've turned to a merciful God and confessed your sins to Him, and ask him to give you His Son to save you and to make you one of His own, that you too might be led on safely, that you fear not? One of the questions that was put to me at the conference at Inverness that I shared with you a few weeks ago was this: do the Lord's people have a harder time in this life than those who are not Christians? Do the Lord's people have a harder time in this life than those who are not Christians? And my answer was yes and no. Yes, because Christians have peculiar trials and troubles that no other person will know, and so for that reason it's a harder time. But no, because Christians have a resort, a God to go to, a peculiar, unique, and wonderful help that no one else has. And that's not just a safe answer, that's a true answer, isn't it? Yes. But thank God, no. He led them on safely so that they feared not, but the sea overwhelmed their enemies. May you know the and not the but. May the Lord bless His word. Let us sing now together hymn number 700.